Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Welcome to the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast. It's your host, Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian. And I'm here today with a guest, Professor Louise Burke, who it's really such an honor to meet with her. And I really appreciated the time that she spent with me recording this episode and diving deep into the questions and topics that I proposed to her. She is the author of the textbooks that I studied in order to pass my board exams. And she's, you know, the author of many publications that I keep up with as a practitioner myself in this field. So it was really such an honor to meet her. And we decided to dive today's conversation into her most recent research on low carbohydrate, high fat, or essentially ketogenic diets and performance. Now, if you're a listener of this podcast, you will know that I preach to eat carbohydrates for performance. And it's because of the research that we have to show that that is the most effective way. However, in true researcher fashion, there's still some questions unanswered or certain populations that we need to dive further into this. And so Professor Burke, who is herself a big fan of carbohydrates for performance, had some unanswered questions. And, you know, so she's gone down the rabbit hole of figuring out, is it possible or what are the possibilities or what are the outcomes of low carb, high fat diets and performance? And so we're going to dive into that mostly and also double tap on a little bit of Red's research. She was on a team of people who came up with the 2023 consensus statement for REDS, or relative energy deficiency in sports. So we'll dig into that as well. Before we jump into this, I just want to remind you that although in 2024, business has shifted for me a little bit, I did want to remind you that on my website, riseupnutritionrun.com, you actually still can have access to a couple of resources that can help you out with your fueling needs. One of them is actually a 12-module online self-study course. It's the ultimate guide to female athlete nutrition. This is an online course that I created after years of running my business, consulting athletes one-on-one. There is so much misinformation out there on nutrition and sports nutrition. And so when I'm working one-on-one with a client, one of the first things we have to do is educate them on sports nutrition, and of course, specifically for female athletes. And that's what I've compiled in this online course. It's 12 modules. You can study it at your own pace. You could do one a week, get it done in 12 weeks. You can do two a week. You can do it at your own pace. You can access the modules as you need them or dive into a topic that you're struggling with at your own discretion. In these 12 modules, there's over 7 hours of instructional video training led by me, videos that I made, content that I made, alongside dozens of downloadable handouts, some sample meal plans and recipes corresponding to those module topics. And this is all here for you to learn, implement, and keep forever. Within each module, I try to have certain challenges so that you can really apply this information to your life. Some of the topics include just fueling fundamentals, pre and post workout, grocery shopping tips and meal planning, fueling to your female hormones, applying intuitive eating concepts to athletic lifestyle and sports nutrition needs, and more. So please head to riseupnutritionrun.com and head to the online course, The Ultimate Guide to Female Athlete Nutrition. Okay, let's get into the conversation. Hello, fans and listeners. Thank you so much for joining. I'm here with Professor Louise Burke, who is a sports dietitian with 40 years of experience in the education and counseling of elite athletes. She worked at the Australian Institute of Sport for 30 years, first as a head of sports nutrition and then as chief of nutrition strategy. She has attended 6 Summer Olympic Games with the Australian Olympic team, 1996 through 2012 and 2021. Her publications include over 400 papers in peer-reviewed journals and book chapters, and the authorship and editorship of several textbooks on sports nutrition. Louise was a founding member of the Executive of Sports Dietitians Australia and is a director of the IOC Diploma in Sports Nutrition. She was awarded a Medal of Order of Australia in 2009 for her contribution to sports nutrition. Louise was appointed as chair in sports nutrition in the Mary McKillop Institute of Health Research at Australian Catholic University in Melbourne in 2014 and took up this position in a full-time capacity in 2020. I just have to say, as a sports dietitian myself, this is crazy to be talking to you. You're the author of the textbooks that I learned from in all of my schooling and education and to pass my CSSD exam. Like, it's kind of surreal right now to like, oh, you're a real person.
Well, you're being very kind. And a lot of what I've done has been a real team effort. And sometimes I get to be the one that gets all the praise, but I can tell you that I rely on the work of a whole lot of really young and wonderful people to make me look good.
Well, humble of you to say. It's just, and I think too, just reading off your bio of 40 years of experience, I mean, that's literally the start of sports nutrition. Sports, like you're kind of a founding person when it comes to working in the field and researching in the field. But, I mean, yeah, this is a new field. And so you've been there throughout it all.
And look, there's a lot of other people who have done things at the same time or before me that have also pioneered. So I don't want to take all the credit, but I will agree with you that, you know, when I studied, it wasn't a known outcome of being a dietitian. And in fact, when I studied dietetics, it was just completely by accident. I didn't know what a dietitian was. I was interested in nutrition and was doing the course and, you know, then heard about what a dietitian was, what I was going to come out at the other end as. And I just thought, wow, so I'm going to get paid for listening to what people eat all day. How good's that? So you can see there's a lot of sort of luck in your life as to the way things go. And, you know, now because of the publicity that we've been able to get for sports nutrition, young people can say, yes, that's what I want to do. I want to be a sports dietitian. And they go into it with a lot more thought and rather than just sort of the serendipitous way that I got there.
Sure, sure. I can understand and appreciate that. And yeah, that's why, you know, even for somebody like me, I'm like this, when I was in college wanting to study sports nutrition, even my mentors were kind of like, that's not really a field. Like only a few people do that. But, you know, you did exist. Nancy Clark, you know, she was out there doing it and she was, you know, one of my role models. I want to do what she's doing. So it's really interesting, just kind of the progression of the field. And I think even just touching a bit on your journey too, it's okay, you're a dietitian, but now after so much experience, you know, writing textbooks, being, you know, the basically somebody who's like chief of nutrition strategy or kind of head of research and things like that. You have, I guess I'm curious to know, like your day to day is very different, I would imagine, than like mine as a dietitian, kind of consulting one-on-one with athletes. Are you kind of really working on more bigger picture research, consensus statements? Like what does kind of life as somebody at your level kind of job, day-to-day job look like right now?
Yeah, so it's quite different now to what it used to be. When I was first at the AIS, it was the most wonderful time. We were a campus that was full of sports programs and coaches and sports scientists all working together on a day-to-day basis. And we, you know, were learning things together, and doing research was about providing the evidence base for what we were doing. So we didn't ever do research to get a publication or to get H index or, you know, some academic metric. And so it was only after a period of time and in sort of accumulating research was very applied that I started to feel that, yes, I do have a role as a researcher. I mean, I thought of myself as a practitioner first.
Yeah.
And then in 2020, as the AIS was changing its model so that it no longer provided that environment of athletes and coaches working together, I thought, well, you know, maybe it is the time to then move into full-time academia as a researcher so that I can make use of all the things that I've learned and do it more strategically, but also, you know, create environments where other people can come and join. And one of the great things I've been able to do, and it's only because I've had that experience of working with athletes, is to set up these new models for doing research. We call them our research embedded training camps. And it came about because the way that sport was being funded in Australia changed, so that with the demise of the AIS as a campus, it meant all the sports were looking after their athletes separately, and some of the sports, you know, lost funding or they lost that daily training environment opportunity. And that has a real impact on many athletes because, you know, they're not in a squad, they're not getting all that interaction with scientists on a day-to-day basis that they had before. And for some sports can manage to provide it for themselves, other sports can't. And so I was able to use research funding to pull these camps together, and it was my incentive was first to provide that training environment for the athletes and to get a collection of people together to share ideas. It was never to say, oh, let's do research and get a paper and become really important as a researcher out of it. But that was sort of an embedded side project. But what we were doing was talking to the athletes and coaches about what are the things that you want to know about, you know, what are the tricky questions in your sport. And when they're invested in that question, then it makes the experience completely different to the previous way that I'd seen research done, where, you know, scientists think up stuff, and then they have to go out and recruit people to come and do the project. And sometimes those people aren't, you know, they're doing it to earn some money or they're doing it
whatever the incentive is.
Yeah. And they're not truly engaged in it. So we just luckily came upon these situations where we'd have these groups of athletes together, and often they were international athletes who didn't normally train with each other, and so you've got an environment suddenly where there's excitement because there's people training together for the first time and they're learning from each other, and there's coaches and there's scientists, and, you know, they help design the studies. You know, we want to say, well, if we want to think this thing, this intervention or this idea enhances performance, how can we measure performance for a start in a way that you truly believe the outcome? You know, I want the athletes to be able to read the paper that comes out of it and say, yep, you know, I was there and we really gave 110%. So I know that these results saw a difference, or they didn't see a difference, because that's the real deal. You know, you hate sort of thinking that people do your study and they kind of dial in a performance as part of the study, and so you're never quite sure whether you can trust that performance side of things. You can measure lots of things and, you know, measure metabolites, or you can measure some things with a lot of precision and feel happy that that was a real finding. But the hardest thing you'll ever measure is performance, because, you know, when it gets to sports performance in real life, you know, what makes someone win a gold medal or break a world record? It's not just the, you know, the physiological benefits or the characteristics they had on that day. It's in being able to summon every ounce of their fibre and their psychology and their commitment and their self-belief, as well as all the physiology and all the other strategies that have led them to the starting line. It's making it all happen on the day. And so we've tried with a lot of our studies to embed performance measurements in there, real-life races that have PBs and are counted as real races, so that, you know, when people are measuring the effect of our interventions, they're actually truly trying to measure performances that would occur in real life. And then we can look back at the results and say, yep, we think that intervention made a difference, because with everything being very well controlled and performance being as realistic as it can be, you know, the results led in that direction, and we're satisfied that that was a realistic outcome.
And another thing I really appreciate about your research, trying to really dial in that performance piece, is the population you're doing it on is an elite level athlete population. So we're really trying to figure out performance for athletes here. And, you know, there's so much research that's done on, you know, a healthy population or an active population, which is great research, but, you know, there is a difference between the, young college age, healthy, active person who's doing recreational soccer and somebody training for the Olympics. And that's where so much of your research, you're measuring performance in people, in real events, real races that are truly training at that high level where those little bits of performance really matter to them. And I think that's something that's really important in the research that you do as well.
And look, I've been so lucky that athletes and coaches and other scientists trust us to do that work, because everyone's putting themselves on the line. You know, it's a real investment from a lot of people in terms of let's work together to get the outcome. So I like to think of what we do as research with athletes, not research on athletes, because if you start with the fact that you're all collaborating together and that you're involving athletes in the process, helping design how it'll work so that the results are realistic. And look, you can't do everything on elite athletes, because sometimes you have to start with questions at the very basic level.
Yeah. And then kind of narrow it down into a niche.
So once you get to the point, though, where you've got a really well thought out strategy that now we need to test in the highest environment, then bringing those athletes in is the way to go. But you have to thank everybody that helped along the way. Those college age people who were the first people to be involved have a role in the process of finding things out. But I love the idea that, you know, if you're wanting to apply results to high performance sport, then you really have to be able to involve them in at least some of the studies so that you can be sure that the genetics, the training, all the things that go into being an elite athlete have been built into whether your intervention does do something on top of all that.
And this is the perfect segue to get into, I kind of wanted to dive into some of your more recent research in the last 5 to 8 years about essentially ketogenic diets or low carb, high fat diets on an elite athletic population. And I say it's a perfect segue because we've had, I don't know how many years, 20 plus years now of discussing ketogenic diets for, you know, quotes around it, performance. And it's like, well, performance for what population? What metrics of performance are we measuring here? And it's just a very, I think, in for the average person, they've heard, oh, is keto good? Is keto bad? It's very confusing and things like that. And you, over the last few years, have actually really dug into low-carb, high-fat diets specific to this elite athlete. Like you said, we've got some research in other populations, other outcomes. How does this really apply now in an athletic population? And I think even, too, I'm going to point out, kind of going back to one of your studies from 2017, which was looking at the race walkers, and you had put them on a low-carb, high fat diet, a high carb diet, and a periodized carbohydrate diet during I believe it was 3-week training program. We can dig into the details a little bit more. But even just reading through like your introduction in that paper, it was kind of mentioned, this was back in 2017, it was mentioned in the introduction that truly very little research has actually been done on low carb, high fat diets in athletes. And I think you and your team of researchers, is more than just you, but, you know, you mentioned a 1983 study and like 2 studies in 2016s as it pertained to endurance athletes. I'm like, wow. So prior to this, you know, study that you did on the race walkers, I'm like, that's really very little science and research on low carb, high fat diets and athletes. That's very, very little, even though I feel like people talk about it all the time. Is that true, or am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely. And we did the first study in 2015. So those two 2016 papers hadn't appeared yet. And we were quite intrigued that the only study that had ever been done with the ketogenic version of fat adaptation was that 1983 study. And so suddenly in 2012, the social media goes crazy with all this stuff about athletes and low-carb diets and how wonderful it is. And we thought, well, where's the evidence? And we thought about it in
One study. Yeah, one study. Wow.
We thought about it in 2 different ways, though. I had done a decade of research looking at high-fat but not ketogenic diets, so restricted carbohydrate but not low to the point of ketogenesis. And we had tried to find ways in which we could retool the muscle to be better at burning fat and still being able to burn carbohydrate. And over a decade, we tried that and got to the point where we realized that as much as you can retool the muscle to increase fat oxidation, it doesn't happen and leave carbohydrate intact so that you get two things that are upregulated. Mm. When you fat adapt, you deregulate carbohydrate oxidation. So that just didn't seem to be. When we got to the point of seeing the muscle retooling and realizing we're now actually impairing carbohydrate oxidation, then it seemed we'd hit a brick wall. There's no point going any further, because even though some sports can work with that, in the Olympic sports that I work with, there's a need for athletes to have an ability to be able to produce power at high intensities, with carbohydrate being the more efficient fuel for doing that. So we left it there. But when, you know, we'd sort of stopped that about 2006. But then, you know, when in 2012, this resurgence of interest in the ketogenic version of the diet suddenly arrived. And remember, you know, social media changed landscapes, because now we've so much more yelling about things. So my first thought is not, oh, they're wrong, but it's always, look, if people are talking about stuff, maybe we missed something. Maybe there was some angle that the ketogenic aspect of the diet does that's different, or maybe we just didn't see something else that might be important. And I'm in the middle of a Twitter war at the moment with some people who refuse to want to be able to think with nuance and complexity about stuff. It's all black and white. So it's keto or carbs, and you have to be one or the other. Yeah. And I can honestly tell you in 2015 that our motivation was to say, did we miss something? Because I want to help athletes go higher, faster, stronger. I don't care where it comes from, whether it's beetroot juice or ketones. It's, if it helps performance and it's safe, effective and legal for use in sport, why wouldn't you want to be part of it? And so we honestly went back to say, is there something that we can find that athletes aren't using now, and we can show that it works and get a handle on how to use it well? So that's what started the Supernova series, and we've now done quite a few of these studies. We haven't found benefits to sports performance in the parameters that we're looking at, and that is in athletes who do endurance events but need to have high intensity parts to the race, either throughout the race or at critical moments. And so we now have sort of hit that brick wall again, where we recognize that even though you can retool the muscle to burn fat at much higher rates, we can double it in our athletes who are already well trained and good at burning fat as a fuel, but we can double it by putting them on a ketogenic diet. The problem is, again, it impairs carbohydrate utilization, so you then can't use that fuel as effectively. And the problem is, when you look at what it costs you in oxygen to produce the ATP from the different fuel sources, carbohydrates more efficient, so you can produce more ATP from the same amount of oxygen. And it gets down to how economical you can be. And so even though fat can sustain exercise at higher intensities, the problem is that you'll be doing it at a lower speed, because less ATP is being produced, the oxygen that you're being able to get to the muscle. And remember that, you know, these athletes are working at 80, 85, 90% of their VO2 max when they're in their intensities in these exercise arenas. So even, you know, even though for the all of the bike race, they may not be at that level. They probably are if they're at the marathon. But even in a bike race where a lot of the race is done at sort of 60, 65% of VO2 max, the getting over the hill, the sprint to the line, all the things that make the winner stand out, they're done at these higher intensities. And if there's an inability to produce the same speed for the oxygen that you're able to deliver the muscle, then that's a problem. And we can see in other examples how important that economy of being able to turn every bit of oxygen that you can deliver to the muscle and burn with fuel into ATP. And the example that, you know, we can talk about now are the super shoes. So what all these super shoes do in track and field is they reduce the oxygen cost of the speed that you're running at, because the energy return that they're able to provide through the carbon plate and through the thick soles means that for the same amount of relative intensity, you're moving faster. And they improve your economy by about 4 to 5%, which is about the same level that fat is less economical than carbohydrate as a fuel. And you can see what's happened in track and field. Every men and women's record has been broken in 5,000 metres up.
Yeah.
With super shoes, just because that's how much difference it makes. So you've got to say to yourself, why would you then want to do something that moves the dial in the opposite direction? So it doesn't matter if you're in a much slower event where you might be working at 60%, 65% of your VO2 max, because if you have to use more of your VO2 max to keep the same speed, so now you have to do it at 69% rather than 65%, most people have the capacity to do that. But it's when you're getting up into these very high intensities where you're going to go over your critical power, where you're then moving into anaerobic production of fuel, which isn't sustainable, then you've got a problem. And so physiologically, you know, we've shown ourselves that we've hit a brick wall for those kinds of events. Now, that doesn't mean there are not sports that could benefit from a ketogenic approach. I'm currently working with a marathon swimmer, and she does a very long event, and it's much more difficult to take in carbohydrate during her event than it is in land-based sports. And it be over her event, you know, we're talking several days, and it also then the whole business of the taste of what she's consuming because of the salt water and the fact that her whole face swells up.
Yeah.
It makes it difficult to consume carbs. So under those conditions where she's moving much more slowly and it's difficult to take in carbs, then it makes sense to say, well, let's not make yourself carb dependent. Let's use the fat source.
Yeah.
And so I'm more than happy to say there are different approaches to doing things. I don't believe that, you know, it's one army versus another and we have to fight to the death to sit. There's room for everybody to be right in different contexts. Just that, you know, most of the sports that I've worked with have been more leaning towards the benefits of having carbohydrate-supported exercise, but now I'm having a chance to work in one that doesn't, and it's fun learning lots of new stuff, and can see that the great thing about sports nutrition is that there's so many different ways of attacking it, and there's different protocols and different strategies that may suit different sports, different events, and different people.
Yeah. A little bit of a tangent here, but I just watched the movie about Diana Nyad.
Right. Yeah. I did too, because I wanted to learn a bit more about
And I knew of her story, but I, like, after watching the movie, I'm like, how the heck did she fuel? I have so many questions. I have so many questions. I don't know. So marathon swimming is, I've never worked with a marathon swimmer, but this just is insane sport.
Exactly. But, you know, if you were being black and white about it and saying there's only one right way of doing things, then you'd miss the opportunity to say, well, new set of circumstances here, new set of physiological limitations, new set of practical limitations. We've got to think differently.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So many things that I just want to kind of hit on or just kind of repeat that you just said. So through, you know, basically multiple different research studies on that you've performed on low carb, high fat diets and performance in athletes, you found, okay, yes, you can increase your fat oxidation, but in doing so, you're also putting more strain on your body, using more oxygen in order to do that. And it's not economical for performance. Performance measures decline. And so I think this is where kind of like, why is society, this is a rhetorical question, but why does society think that fat oxidation is so cool? Like, I think that's something people are trying to like, oh, I want to oxidize more fat. And it's like, but that's from an athletic perspective, if that's ultimately not necessarily the best for performance in some of these more traditional sports that we're talking about, then it's funny that people still think that's like some holy grail that they need to achieve, burning more fat. But at the end of the day, actually, carb oxidation is, for most sports, maybe not something like marathon swimming or in different scenarios that we have to think outside the box, but for most sports, carb oxidation is going to be the most effective for performance measures.
Yeah. And look, I think sometimes people they have a little bit of knowledge and they mix the things up. And so often when people think about fat oxidation, they're thinking, well, if I'm burning more fat, then I might have less body fat myself, so I might lose weight. Instead of thinking about energy balance being the most important there, you know, if you might be burning more fat, but you're eating more fat to produce that diet. So it's sort of cancelling out the fact that,
yeah,
it's all, you know, so people have inadequate full understanding, I think, of physiology. And so sometimes they hear something that sounds good without understanding the bigger picture of what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think people think fat oxidation sounds good. And the bigger picture is that's most likely not ideal for performance goals as an athlete. And potentially even just, I think, going back to, you know, what fits your lifestyle. And you mentioned if you can eat carbohydrates, then you should. Maybe there's certain situations where you can't, like in the marathon swimming. I worked with special operations for a couple of years, and they, on certain deployments and certain missions, like, didn't have food availability. And that was a concept that I was toying with of, oh, maybe in this scenario, adjusting their bodies to fasting or being fat adapted so they can just have, you know, or one meal a day would be beneficial in this type of population. You know, so there's certainly situations where thinking outside the box might be helpful. But for, I think, the everyday athlete, the elite level athlete, somebody who has the availability to eat carbohydrate, that seems to be where most of the research is still pointing towards. This is going to be the best for performance.
Yeah. And look, I think you've summed it up. It's about being open enough to be able to consider every aspect and understand the physiology and the practicalities of what's happening. And look, I know a lot of people that, you know, when I go and run a big city marathon, there are people that are doing it in 6 hours and 7 hours. Now, they're not doing the same race that I am, and I'm not doing the same race that Kipchoge's doing, because we're working at different relative and absolute intensities. But, you know, maybe some of those people aren't needing to be as carb supported as I want to try and be, because their race is a different one. Even though we're on the same course, you know, the physiology of what they're doing is different. So I'm lucky that I get to work with the higher level people, so I see things from one perspective. But, you know, we've got to remember that a lot of the other people that might be doing the same thing, doing something slightly different.
Absolutely, yeah. And I want to hit on, I think, about which study it was for you, or honestly, you might have hit on it in a couple of your studies, but one of your studies looked at this theory behind, well, what if I train kind of like low carb, but then perform high carb? That's another kind of trendy thing people have talked about as well. Train low carb, kind of fat adapt, but on race day or the day before race day, I'll bulk up my carbohydrate. And I think, you know, I think the summary is everything we just went over, but could you dig into that theory and what you found a little bit more?
Yeah. So when we found that the ketogenic diet by itself wasn't going to be useful because of this limitation of fat oxidation, we started thinking, well, you know, can we put the two fuels together? And I mean, I didn't want to leave it alone at this point. I still wanted to see, is there any way in which we can combine strategies and, you know, get to the bottom of where it might be useful? So in one of our studies, we did fat adapt or keto adapt the athletes, and then we had them carbo load for a day before they went into the race, and they had a pre-event meal. So we were trying to then load them up with both liver and muscle glycogen on top of their keto adaptation. And we didn't find any improvement. In fact, we found that their performance was impaired compared to the group that had done the high carbohydrate approach the whole time. And when, with the ketogenic adapted group, we got them to do their race warm up in the lab. It was a real race they did. It was on a track that is nearby to the AIS. And so one of the benefits of doing the study at the AIS was that we're able to grab the keto guys and take them into the lab and get them to do their warm-up with gas being collected so that we could look at what their substrate utilization was. And that allowed us to then sort of understand why their race performance was impaired. And what we found is that even though they were comparing what they had done 3 weeks before when they were carbo-loaded on a high carbohydrate training diet, and then this time, the next one, we got them to do the keto adaptation and then carbo-loaded them the same way. Now, we can't put holes in elite athletes, so I couldn't take a muscle biopsy to make sure that the glycogen level's the same, but we would have assumed they'd be pretty similar because we gave them exactly the same diets for that 24-hour period prior to the race.
Yeah.
And when we looked at them in the lab in the warm-up, we found that their utilization of carbohydrate was reduced for every speed that we got them to do mm-hmm. as their warm-up. And so from that, it repeated what we had seen in our previous studies, that the cost of the keto adaptation is that you reduce the activity of some of the enzymes that are really important in carbohydrate mm-hmm. oxidation. As I said, we didn't do it in this group, but previously in a group of well-trained athletes who did let us take muscle biopsies, we'd found that the enzyme that breaks down glycogen was reduced in activity, but most importantly, the enzyme that's involved in taking carbohydrate into the pyruvate cycle, into the TCA cycle, the Krebs cycle. So pyruvate dehydrogenase is what we consider the rate-limiting step in that carbohydrate oxidation cycle. It helps the carbohydrate, the glycogen's broken down to pyruvate, and that then goes into the TCA cycle. And that enzyme is the one, it's sort of like the traffic cop that lets you into the roundabout. And mm-hmm. when it's reduced in activity, then the rate at which you can oxidize carbohydrates reduced. And that we saw then the mechanism, it wasn't just they had so much fat to burn, they were burning more fat. It was that there was a break on the carbohydrate story. So it didn't matter how much carbohydrate we had primed them with, it wasn't going to be as effectively used in that race. And that's or why we think that the race performance was similarly impaired, because even though you provided the carbohydrate, it can't contribute as much as it would have done previously. Now, we did a short race for our performance measurements, because even though the races that the race walkers do in the Olympic program at that stage were up to 50K, which is a 3.5-hour event, you can't get athletes to do two full-out performances so close together. Like you need more than 3 weeks to be able to repeat a full-on performance of the 50K. But the athletes, when we talked about it, were happy to do two 10K races, 10,000-metre mm-hmm. races, that they would do at absolute top speed. And, in fact, over our Supernova series, the World Athletics Association adopted our races. They recognised our races and they put them onto their World Athletics program. So that's now one of the things, you know, with our studies, that when athletes are recruited, we can say that you will get to compete in a World Athletics event, so that if you do a PB, it counts. You know, there'll be drug tests, all the things that, and there'll be prize money and there'll be points and all the things that help you to then be able to qualify for your country's Olympic Games or World Championships or whatever it is. And so that's one of the ways that, as I said, that we try and make our performance measures realistic, because they are they carry all the benefits or all the things in performance that athletes care about. And so no athlete's going to go into that race and think, oh, I'll just, you know, give it a try, but I'm not going to really put myself on the line. You know, the athletes will do their absolute best job on the day. But the good thing is that we've been able to control all the preparation leading into that with the intervention, so that they'll be able to see exactly what that intervention did under those real race circumstances.
Yeah. I love your approach to that. I think it's wonderful. And then, going back to just that idea of the training with low carbohydrate, but then filling up your glycogen stores, it's not just glycogen is one thing, but it's not just that. It's on a cellular level, the enzymes have changed when you've adapted, fat adapted. And so it's not just all about glycogen storage all the time. And so that's so interesting and really important for people to understand.
One of the other things We didn't measure in this particular study because it was a short performance. If we had done a 50K race, then we would have had the opportunity to take carbohydrate in during that race as well. But one of the things we were worrying about was, if you've been on a ketogenic diet, have you down-regulated your intestinal ability to absorb carbohydrate? Because we know that training with carbohydrate increases carbohydrate absorption. Mm-hmm. So we'd assume that cutting all the carbohydrate out of your diet will do the opposite effect. So that would be another thing that athletes would need to think about. And in fact, there's a nice case history that's in the literature that concerns an Ironman triathlete who was a ketogenic diet follower, and he, after reading some of the literature, was worried that he was perhaps missing out on the carbohydrate effect. And so he decided to stay keto but do some of his sessions in the week using higher carbohydrate approaches, so that he would not only get the benefit from training, but he'd keep his gut being able to absorb at least at some level, so that when he did it on race day, it would not be so much of a shock to the system. So there's different ways of still thinking about things, and we've probably now at the end of what we want to do with ketogenic diet, because there's so many other things that you can study, and you've got to think about what's the best bang for your buck. But
you've spent a number of years on it, and you've come to some pretty solid conclusions, and you're kind of like, okay, what's the next thing now? Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, that's another point too. Yeah, it's like we need, your carbohydrates, your glycogen affects performance, but then we also have on the cellular level, how the muscle is working. And then that digestion piece is another piece of that, and how well your body is digesting these nutrients. And so that's a great point, because I've definitely seen that as a practitioner, people who come to me having a pretty low carbohydrate intake, they even struggle with the digestion of carbohydrate. They're telling me that with just their symptoms of, bloating and nausea after trying to increase their carbohydrates. It's like, so it's to oversimplify kind of that supply and demand on the body. The less that you've fueled your body with carbohydrates, the less your body's created those digestive enzymes to tolerate them. And so you need to keep fueling with them to put that demand on your body to support the digestion of it.
That's right.
So, yeah. And, I'm kind of kicking myself right now, because there was one other topic on this topic of ketogenic diets that I thought was interesting, and I completely forgot to read the research study, and I didn't even write it down. But as we're talking, I'm like, I forgot about that. You had at least one, maybe more, studying like ketones specifically, correct?
Yeah, so we've done a little bit of work with the ketone esters, because again,
like as a supplement?
Yes, the supplement. So the ketone esters are a way of increasing your blood ketone levels without having to do the diet. And so it's been proposed that if there are some benefits of the ketone bodies themselves, not the fat oxidation part of things, then maybe you could be able to take the ketone ester and get that same effect immediately. And the two benefits of that is that you have the ability to keep periodizing carbohydrate and ketones, if you like, so that you've got more opportunity with the training process, that you can have high carbohydrate training and some ketone training, but you can modulate the way that you're approaching it rather than being flatline keto. And then also on race day, you've got potentially another fuel source to add on board. So in our particular study, we were thinking not so much about the carbs and the ketones going together, but whether the ketone esters on top of a keto adapted scenario would provide any benefit. Again, we were thinking about the fact that the keto adaptation was still missing the ability to have some kind of a fuel that you could use at a more effective and more economical top end, and we wondered if the ketone esters would do that, but we didn't see any benefit. Ketone esters didn't change fuel metabolism. We don't think that the ketone bodies themselves are a major source of fuel for the muscle. They may be being used by other parts of the body, but in terms of contributing to the exercise fuel, they don't seem to make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I was working with the military population in 2015, 2016, I feel like that was a hot topic of the ketone supplements and ketone esters. And I don't know if it's just because I'm not in that population anymore or I've just stopped following the research, but I feel like it's kind of died down a little bit. But I'm, you know, it'd be interesting to see where that goes. But yeah, so it didn't necessarily help in when it comes to muscle and performance as an athlete, not finding anything significant in that particular study.
And I think there's still a lot of interest in other effects of the ketone bodies. So yeah. There's interest in what they do as a brain fuel. Mm-hmm. And part of the military interest, I think, too, is just that whole period of, as you said, of deployments when you don't have access to other fuel sources, that mm-hmm. being able to have the ketone esters and maybe in a situation of being keto adapted yourself,
yeah,
then there may be some benefits from cognitive performance points of view that the ketone yeah. bodies can provide.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what we were thinking at that time. But okay. I have one final question on the topic of low carb, high fat, and I feel like then we've exhausted it. But I just kind of want to point out again, you did a 6-day study looking at low carb, high fat diets, not necessarily on performance markers of, you know, time to finish or fat oxidation, things like that, but actually on immunity and iron status. And, you know, some things that I kind of took away from that was the athletes that did six days of low carb, high fat diets. Was it 6 days? Am I getting this correct?
Yeah, look, we've done different lengths of our keto adaptation. And yeah. in all our studies, because we have the athletes there in the camp and we've got so much time to study them, both to control what they're doing, but also to see what's happening, we decided to have a look at lots of different aspects of metabolism, not just the performance aspects of it, but right. what's the rest of the body doing? Because we know that there's a lot of crosstalk. The muscle, when it's exercising, produces myokines, little messenger proteins that go out to other parts of the body and have an effect. And that's one of the benefits of exercise and how it achieves effects on different parts of the body. And because we were doing the study, we thought, well, it's a good chance to be able to see if there's a change in the way that the exercise myokines are having communication with other systems.
Yeah.
So we were particularly interested in IL-6, interleukin-6. It's an interesting cytokine in that it can do both positive and negative things in the body. But one of the things it does is it communicates with the immune system and with bone mm-hmm. and with iron regulation. And in our studies, whether it's over 6 days or whether it's over our 3 weeks, we found that when athletes are exercising in high carbohydrate preparation or in the keto adaptation state, there's a difference in the IL-6 response to exercise. That when the muscle has got low glycogen levels and you're exercising, it produces a much higher IL-6 response. And so then we mm-hmm. tracked what happens in the body as a result of that increase in IL-6. And we found that it has effects that seem to reduce some of the immune benefits of exercise. It has mm-hmm. effects that change iron regulation. So it increases hepcidin, which is mm-hmm. the product that the body uses to regulate iron stores. It both reduces iron absorption and it reduces the amount of recycling of iron in the body when blood cells and muscle cells break down and release their iron. There's a system that can recycle that, but the hepcidin interferes with that. So it's the way the body has to try and reduce iron availability. And we found that when you exercise with the ketogenic diet, then the hepcidin response is increased, which means that iron is the regulation or the availability of iron is reduced. Mm-hmm. We also found bone responds to the IL-6 message, and not in a good way, that when you do the exercise in the ketogenic diet, so exercise with low glycogen and higher IL-6 production, then the biomarkers of bone breakdown are increased and bone formation are decreased. So
yeah.
These are all things that we found as just a byproduct of our studies. and people have criticized us for saying, yes, but you didn't power your study to look at that as the primary outcome. And we're more than happy to say, no, we didn't. But these are exploratory outputs from the studies, and they then give you ideas about whether it's worth doing a study that simply focuses on that. And so it does fit in with other knowledge that we have. Some of the populations that are on ketogenic diets, such as people with intractable epilepsy, they often have low bone density, and there's a lot of sort of interfering reasons for that. A lot of those children are on other medication and they may not have the same exercise ability, so that could contribute to the poor bone health. But because it is a big issue, because, you know, we are worried about bone health in athletes for other reasons, it was a good idea to have a look at that, and it's certainly given us an area of interest to follow up with more targeted studies that might be able to interrogate it better.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think that's, you know, you do one research study and you learn other things that you weren't intending to learn, or, you know, picked up some observations. It's great to point that out. And then you, you know, you or somebody else can dive into that further. But it's definitely, I mean, these are all kind of, you know, I'm a visual person, just like dots that you start just kind of connecting the dots, right? Like, oh, this makes sense that the low-carb diets, you know, increase bone breakdown. And that's why we see so many people on low-carb diets with bone issues and the epilepsy and all that stuff. It's like, oh, we're connecting dots. And yeah, we need that targeted research to be more confident or secure in drawing the line between the two. But I think, you know, again, as a practitioner, like, I feel like I see that in my clients, you know, certainly athletes attempting low carb diets, they do tend to have more injuries or iron problems, bone issues. So it's kind of, to me, it's like, it's one of those things that's like, you feel like you see it as a practitioner, you see it in your clients, and now, aha, there it is, you know, observed in a study, which is kind of just makes me more confident as a practitioner as well in my recommendations. So like I said, thank you so much for diving into that, because as a carb lover, I don't think I've spoken much about keto diets on this podcast because I'm, you know, a little biased. I'm not as open-minded as you as a researcher. I'm a little bit like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, we're going to keep eating our carbs. And you have this great mind of a researcher who's open to everything and investigating. So I don't think I've spoken much on a ketogenic diet on this podcast because I've in a way just been, you know, pro-fueling and pro-carbohydrates. But from that scientific perspective, it is so great to have this deep conversation, really understanding the science behind it and what population, and also thinking outside that box. I'm really excited for your work with this marathon swimmer, especially after watching the movie about Naiad. I'm super pumped about that now. So that's really exciting.
Excellent.
Yeah. So we're coming up a little close to our time, but I would also just like to touch briefly just a few minutes on REDS a little bit. Again, kind of going back to what we talked about in the beginning, just your career as a dietitian, as a researcher. You know, REDS is a newer term, 10 years now, but a newer term. And more recently with the 2023 consensus statement, which you were part of a team of people kind of coming together with that updated consensus statement after 10 years of more targeted research on REDS. I would just love to hear your perspective of just kind of like what it's like to be a part of, you know, the research behind and consensus statements of kind of pulling stuff together to literally have like a new diagnosis, really. It's a diagnosis that we didn't have 15 years ago, per se.
And look, it's an interesting experience, because at one level you feel privileged and you feel happy that you've drawn people's attention to something that's important. But I think one of the things that the 2023 update wanted to do was to try and rebalance the perspective on it. And I think, you know, one of the things that often happens in not just sports nutrition is that when you learn something new and then you try and educate people about it, you try and package it in a way that's simple and digestible. And when you do that, one of the disadvantages is that suddenly everybody understands it and everybody's now looking for it and everybody finds it everywhere they look. And it's the same in so many different areas of sports nutrition. I remember when we first became able to measure ferritin and understand its relationship to iron status, and then suddenly every athlete in the world was iron deficient because, you know, we're now measuring ferritins and we're overinterpreting what we're reading. And when we could measure vitamin D, suddenly every athlete's vitamin D deficient because, you know, suddenly we're measuring it all the time. And I think one of the things that's possibly happened with the Reds area is that people now have been running around measuring low energy availability or measuring energy intake and energy expenditure from exercise in athletes and coming up with numbers that make it look like that athlete is not consuming or there isn't an energy mismatch and that athlete has low energy availability. And so suddenly we're seeing all these studies, oh, you know, we took group of athletes and we assessed energy availability and they've all got low energy availability, so they've all got reds. And what we've tried to do with this update is to reposition things to say energy availability is related to reds, so low energy availability is an exposure variable, but reds is the functional impairment, it's an outcome, it's the disease, if you like. And not all low energy availability leads to that. There's characteristics of that low energy availability exposure that have to be fairly serious before the body has enough disturbance to have functional outcomes that are problematic, but also that we have moderating factors. So it's not just low energy availability that leads to these problems. Everybody has genetic backgrounds, people eat differently, they train differently, they may be taking medication, they may have different levels of stress in their lives. There are so many other things that go on that explain why you can have two athletes who have the same diet and the same training almost, so you could say that they've got the same energy availability, but one has problems and one doesn't. And so this now, we're trying to get to better complexity of understanding, try not to over diagnose people just based on an assessment of what their energy intake and their exercise energy expenditure is, because there are so many problems with measuring that. It's an imprecise measurement of both, and that what we try now to recognize is we really need to be having better diagnostic tools that are standardized to start looking at some of the outcomes. And of course you can then go back and look at energy and its different intakes and expenditure characteristics to see whether it does make sense that this is contributing to the problems that you're seeing. But we're really trying to teach people to be much better with using diagnostic tools and also knowing that there are differential diagnoses for all these problems that can be part of the Red syndrome. So trying to avoid people jumping to conclusions with doing their assessments. We're also trying to have people not jumping to conclusions when an athlete walks in and has a stress fracture and previously has had iron deficiency. Oh, there's reds. No, there are many reasons why that athlete could have the problems. And what we need to do now is make people better at being, you know, far more investigative with the way they approach this. And that's both in trying to prevent it occurring, but also recognizing that it can have happened and what you do about it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think I agree with you that I, as a practitioner, I like that there's a term reds. I like that, you know, female athlete triad, that was one thing. And we've, you know, expanded and had more research. But it once again, it's crazy. Maybe social media, as you mentioned earlier, really has just changed the landscape. How it's like reds is like, it feels like it's everywhere now. And I'm somebody who works with people who are concerned about reds or think that they might have it, but it still is, you know, it's like not everybody has this. And I really appreciated in the consensus statement that differentiation between just the terms of like adaptive low energy availability versus problematic low energy availability, because I think that's something that has confused people over the years is, I can never have low energy intake or like, even though certain people maybe weren't needing or trying to lose weight, but it's like, but if low energy availability is so bad, then how does anybody ever lose weight, right? It started to confuse people. And it's like, yes, because there's problematic, is it a problem or not in your life? And so I think, you know, we still got more research to be done, but I really enjoyed the 2023 consensus statement. I thought it was really insightful, especially, you know, the 2014 to 2018, some differences there, but I felt like the 2023 really as a practitioner provided me with more insight, more terminology to enhance my practice, actually. So, and I think another thing too is, yeah, I think when it first came out, just even talking about low energy availability, people got hooked on numbers, you know, energy availability of 30 to 45, and people got really hooked on those numbers. When we don't have that research yet, it can be a wide range, and what's appropriate energy availability for one person might be totally different than another. Somebody might function optimally at energy availability of 32 and somebody else might need 50. I mean, there's a wide range and it's very individualized. So I think that was another point in the consensus statement that you guys made pretty clear. Don't get too attached to these numbers here.
Thanks for picking that up, because that is the message that we wanted to get out. Yeah.
Well, Professor Burke, this has been just such an educational conversation. I loved digging into the research with you. I appreciate that. I think my listeners will as well. To wrap this up, I have just a few fun questions, lighten the mood a little bit. If there was one food that you could eat every single day for the rest of your life and never get sick of it, what would it be?
Oh, chocolate. Everyone knows it.
Chocolate, Chanel. What was the other thing that you love? I learned
champagne.
About you. Champagne. Chocolate, Chanel, and champagne. You're a lover of all the CH things. I love it. What is your favorite sport to participate in?
Running. I have done other sports, but I've gotten back to running because it's just so time efficient, and I love both doing it with other people and enjoying the interaction, but I love just going out by myself too and thinking and listening to podcasts and enjoying myself.
I love that. And I know we didn't hit on it in this podcast, but you're quite the athlete yourself in multiple sports, running, Ironmans, triathlons. And so, you know, you're speaking about this from working with athletes, from researching athletes, and from being an athlete yourself, which is really impressive. So I love that running is your passion. And how about as a spectator? Do you have a favorite sport to watch?
Oh, look, I love Australian rules football. That's the sport that my family follows and we go together. But all the sports that I've worked with, I've come to appreciate, and I've come to appreciate not just the sport, but the athletes. And so, you know, if you said to me in 2010, what do you think about race walking? I would have said, oh, that's a stupid sport. But now that I've become a devotee and know the athletes, I love watching it because I know the stories, I know the history, I know the culture and the excitement. So there's almost no sport that I don't enjoy watching, particularly when I've had a chance to interact with the people that are doing it.
Yeah. I agree with you too. I think most of my life I was like, golf, no. And then through working at the collegiate level, I got to work with golf teams. I'm like, I loved working with the golf teams. I loved being out on the course with them. So once you get that experience of you're a lover of sports and you appreciate the people, I love that. And yeah, race walking, I was actually, sorry to ask you one more question, but is that popular in Australia? Is that a popular sport?
It is. Relatively, because we've done so well. So our athletes are known because, you know, they've won gold medals and they're more well known than in other countries.
Yeah. Not as popular here in the US, but you never know. Things might take a turn in the future. Okay. My final fun question for you, being that this is the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast, if there's a female athlete out there, either just in your personal life or more well known, that you want to give a shout out to for being an inspiration or a role model, who would that be?
Oh, there's so many, but I'm just going to say Jemima Montague, who's a race walker. She's just so wonderful. She's studying medicine. She's such a giving person, and she's been really important in lots of our studies. And now that I've moved to Melbourne, I'm looking forward to being able to go out and do some training with her, because when she walks, she's moving at my running pace. So that tells you something about what a good athlete she is.
Yeah. That is crazy impressive, actually. Well, amazing. Thank you so much. This wonderful conversation. It was just such a pleasure to meet you, and I appreciate all your insight and knowledge.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition,
then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie. Please go check them out and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide. Or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.